You're listening to episode 79 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Cheng.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Cheng, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
Hey, what's up, Storyteller Tribe? I'm really excited to share that we're in the middle of setting up an online shop for 88 Cups of Tea. We're working hard at making sure that whatever we offer will add tremendous value to your storytelling process. We're also going to have some fun 88 Cups of Tea swag available in our online shop. But for now, we set up a temporary PayPal link for those of you who'd love to support our show and rock your 88 Cups of Tea swag. To grab your limited edition 88 Cups of Tea mug signed by yours truly, head over to 88cupsoftea.com/mug. Thank you so much in advance for showing your love and supporting our show. On to the next part of our intro. If you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with fellow writers, or if you'd like to submit questions for future guests on our show, join me over in our Facebook group at facebook.com/group/88cupsoftea. You'll also get sneak peeks of our publishing calendar for future episodes. And for my craft-focused writers, there's tons of love, support, and encouragement, and pretty awesome advice passed around in this special community of ours. I can't wait to meet you in there. Now on to our show. I'm so excited to have Jeff Zentner with us today. Jeff is the William C. Morris Award-winning author of his debut novel, The Serpent King. His debut was also selected as a New York Times Notable Book and an Amazon Best Book of the Year. Both BuzzFeed and Mashable named The Serpent King as one of the best young adult books of 2016. His second novel, Goodbye Days, was recently released to rave reviews. Time magazine selected Goodbye Days as one of the 5 new books that guide young readers through hardships and struggles with lessons in resilience and hope. In today's episode, we dive right into the inspiration behind The Serpent King and Goodbye Days. Jeff walks us through his thought process while writing authentic voices for his main characters. We dive further into step-by-step advice on building strong characters and improving character development. Jeff also shares tips on approaching difficult scenes that challenge readers and how to write about grief in fiction. We also discuss how storytelling inspires empathy and why it's necessary for writers to carve out protected time for their writing. Now let's jump right in.
Hey everyone, you guys are going to be so excited. We have Jeff Zentner on the show with us today. Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm so good. We had a little chat before this, and you had an awesome weekend. Jeff has some great family news. Jeff, would you like to share a little bit of that?
Yeah, my grandmother died. She was actually eaten by a bear. I don't know why Ian is so excited. No, actually, if your grandmother really was eaten by a bear, I do apologize. My brother got married, and it was actually very cool.
So I love that. Jeff, you are the author of The Serpent King, and you swept up all the awards. Congratulations to you for that. That's amazing. How do you feel?
Well, thank you. I feel great. It's been such an honor to see the way the book has been received. I mean, especially because I did not have high expectations for how it would be received. I wrote this story that I kind of had to tell, and it's this very quiet story that takes place in rural Tennessee and deals with bizarre snake handling religion and lots of things that if there were 30 people in the YA community who were interested in reading that, I would have been just unbelievably excited. So it's been tremendously exciting. Even just while I was waiting to talk to you, I got another email that it was picked as a finalist for this Maryland State Reading Award.
Oh my gosh, congrats.
Thank you. It's been unbelievably exciting. I couldn't be more pleased and surprised.
Well, we're not surprised. I would really love to know and dive into your upbringing and how you grew up. You grew up in Tennessee.
Well, I kind of grew up all over the place, but I've lived most of my life in Tennessee. So I just say I'm from Tennessee now because it saves me from having to tell a long, involved life story. Yeah, we can go with Tennessee.
The Serpent King, of course, number one, what I loved about it was the relationships between the best friends. I think that's really refreshing to read. Did you draw these relationships from your real life friendships growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I was kind of a misfit in high school, and I had my little small coterie of friends that were kind of my strength and my rock. There weren't many of us, but it was just this small group, and we fit in with each other where we didn't fit in with anybody else. So that was one influence on the friendships in the book. I've just always really been drawn to friendships and stories. I love the book, The Outsiders. I grew up just obsessed with Stephen King and the way that he writes friendship. For example, in the novella, The Body, that Stand By Me is based on, I think that's just an absolutely gorgeous friendship in that story. In the book, It, I think there's a really gorgeous depiction of friendship. He's got these beautiful friendships that are at the core of his stories. And I grew up loving them so much and really finding a lot of comfort and solace in stories about close friendships.
Wow. From there, how were you able to break down? I understand these books really had a huge impact on you. How do you take that and break it down so then you could translate it into your own work? Was it just the feeling that it left you and you drew from that inspiration? Or did you actually, because there are some authors that I spoke to before, which I found really fascinating, and they take it almost like a formulaic way where they'll go through and go back to the books that they loved or they really admire, right? And then they read through everything and they start analyzing and seeing these blueprints and these structures so that they can restructure it for themselves. Did you do anything similar to that?
Yeah, and I think I know what you mean. They kind of get under the hood and reverse engineer it to work for their
story. Yeah.
I didn't do anything that organized. I was really intimidated by the thought of writing a book because I had spent most of my creative career in music, where songs are 3 or 4 minutes. You don't have to have the protagonist of your song change or go through any sort of arc or journey necessarily. You can, but that's not really required in songwriting. And I didn't have any training in writing. I didn't ever study creative writing in college. I've never had a creative writing class. So it was really intimidating to me. So what I thought was the easiest way to do this is going to be to allow my characters to lead me through the story by the hand. If I can act as a scribe, where they're telling me their story as opposed to me telling them their story, that's going to work out better, I think. What I did was I thought about the types of people who fascinated me at that point in my life, and it's the three basic archetypes that appear in The Serpent King. The lonely, haunted musician who's struggling with faith was this archetype I had in mind. The sassy internet personality whose internet fame brings her no cachet in her own home place. And then the third was the blue-collar fantasy nerd. So I had these three archetypes in mind. I knew I wanted to write characters along the lines of those archetypes. So I just invited them into my head for a good 3 or 4 months for a process that I now call the residency. And they just literally take up residency inside my mind and talk to each other and talk to me. I sit as a fly on the wall to their conversations and listen to them banter and listen to them react to the world. And they accompany me and I learn their story. I tease out their story to the point when they're just really clawing at the inside of my head. I can feel that my head is no longer big enough to contain them. And I let them out by writing them. And at that point, I know them well enough that I'm writing while they tell me their story. That's kind of how that happened. And I think the process of growing up with all these wonderful stories of friendship, these Stephen King stories, The Outsiders, I used to love John Bolaire's books, House of the Clock in Its Walls, those sorts of books that all involved really deep friendships between outcasts. When I went to write a story like that, I didn't have to think about it much. I just had the muscle memory all ready to go.
It sounds to me almost as if this friendship was continuing on in your head and the conversations were going on and just letting the characters sit and brew. It almost sounded like it was consistent. Were there days where it was complete silence? And if there were, did you have a certain ritual that you stirred up and inspire them to get back out like a muse?
They were always there. There were never days that they were completely silent, but they always chattered the loudest when my mind was the quietest. And my mind is always the quietest when I'm doing a repetitive physical activity without any distractions. So I would go on a lot of walks at night. I would leave my phone at home. I would leave my iPod at home and just listen to the sounds of the night, the sounds of my own heartbeat, look at the colors of the night and just be in that moment. And in that quietness of that moment, that's when they would really speak to me. There's something meditative to me about going on a walk and exerting yourself enough that the exertion itself isn't a distraction, but enough that it's creating a calm in your mind. And that's when they would really talk to me. I've never gone on a walk where I didn't come back with a solution to a problem. That's my big secret to defeating writer's block.
That's super helpful. I do appreciate that. The characters Dill, Lydia, and Travis are all fascinating. I always find it's interesting when authors are able to really get in the mind of the opposite sex. I know you already had these characters brewing in your mind and they were with you in these long walks. For Lydia specifically, her voice, her habits, her nuances, her tics, everything. Are you very close with, I'm not sure, siblings, sisters, or cousins? How did you make her so real?
First of all, let me just thank you. I think that's the most tremendous compliment. I mean, I love the character of Lydia, and I wanted her to be so well drawn, and I wanted her to be such a good character. It was so important to me. And the reason for that is also, I think, to what I would attribute her writing, is that I've got so many amazing women friends. I mean, just extraordinary, so brilliant, so funny, so spirited. They absolutely leave me in awe. And I wanted Lydia to be them as a teenage girl. I would just talk with them and I would just listen to them and listen to the way they talk and look at the way they interacted with the world. Just kind of try to absorb their spirit in a way so that I could reproduce it in Lydia's voice. It really was just a process of being observant. But even more than that, it was just, they say to write what you know, and that's good advice. But my advice is write what fascinates you, write who fascinates you, and write who you love. And these amazing women friends of mine are the people who fascinate me. They're the people I love. And it was just so important to me to try to depict them realistically and to capture what it was that I love so much about them and that so completely draws me to them. And in fact, I loved writing Lydia so much that now I'm working on my third book and I'm doing two teenage girls as protagonists and alternating between their points of view. It's going to be a comedy. Done two pretty heavy books so far, and that one's going to be a comedy. I get to live in that headspace again where I'm reproducing the voices and the spirit and the jokes and the insights of these friends of mine who I love so much. And it's such a wonderful headspace to be in. I wanted to be in that headspace for an entire book, not even leaving it for a second. So that's where I'm at now.
That's so cool. Okay, so since you mentioned this, are you allowed to give us a little bit more detail? Or no, not yet. You want to hold off on that?
Oh, yeah, totally. I'll give you some more detail. Let me just give you kind of the origin story of how this happened, because it was one of those magical moments. I came home one night in February and just started flipping through channels on a Saturday night. And this is not something I ever do. I have to emphasize how completely not a thing this is for me to just sit on my couch and just start aimlessly flipping through channels. There are so many Netflix shows I want to watch, so many books I want to read. So for me to just sit down and start flipping channels, hoping to land on something, is so unheard of. But I do land on something pretty crazy. So Nashville has two public access stations. One is your normal public access station. The other is specifically devoted to art. They have these crazy public domain performances of Shostakovich and these low-rent Songwriter in the Round shows, it being Nashville. This time, they were showing this horror movie. It looked like the late 60s or 70s, really grainy film, one of those horror movies with bad effect, but the movie itself, the quality of the movie itself is so creepy and snuff filmish that you're like, ooh, this is kind of scary. And I'm like, what on earth is going on here? I watch it for a while, and there's this interlude where it's revealed that this horror movie is being shown as part of this show called Midnight Mausoleum. And it's a public access show that's syndicated out of someplace in rural Iowa. And it's these two young girls who run the show.
Oh.
They look to be in their 20s. They were photogenic, but not necessarily terrific TV personalities. It was clearly something they did for fun on the side. They were not professional TV people. Here I was in Nashville, Tennessee on a Saturday night watching them do silly skit. One of the things that fascinates me about the world is connection, how we randomly connect with people and how we randomly stumble upon things. And so it got me thinking about a story where two teenage girls run these horror hosts, is what this whole thing is called. Elvira was a very prominent horror host. She would do some silly little interludes and then show a horror movie. So I came up with a story about two girls who did that. They each have their motivations for being a horror host. One girl is using it to connect with her absent father. One girl is using it because she's got this dream of being on television someday professionally. They run the show out of Jackson, Tennessee, where I go once a month for work. So I know the city and I get a free research trip out of it each month. It's one of these cities that is just big enough that it's kind of got every chain restaurant, but nothing else. It's a city of 80,000 people, and it's got a minor league baseball team and one movie theater and a Sam's Club, a Chili's and an Applebee's and a Five Guys, and that's the city. So it's not small enough to have the romance of a small town, but it's far too small to have anything good about a big city. Towns that size are fascinating to me. This new book I'm working on is called TV Six. It is a comedy. Whereas Serpent King and my second book, Goodbye Days, had about a 70 to 30% ratio of tragedy to comedy, I'm trying to flip that ratio for TV Six to where it's more 70% comedy, 30% tragedy.
Are you having fun with it?
I'm having so much fun. Every funny thought I have goes into the notes for this book, and I try to incorporate it in there.
Oh, man, that's awesome. How does it feel to just switch the complete 180 from tragedy comedy to then what you're saying to more majority comedy to tragedy? Has it been difficult, or is it you find it natural?
Well, here's the funny thing. I see tragedy and comedy as being super interrelated, really,
true,
really closely related. I watch TV shows like Louie, and I think Louie is the best example of this, where it's not a funny show, but it is a funny show. There is so much sadness and melancholy in the show, and that's what's funny. So I've always been able to see a really distinct link between tragedy and comedies. It's not as big of a switch as you would expect, especially because I did try to incorporate a healthy amount of comedy in the first two books to sort of leaven the tragedy in them, so it's not such an incredible slog to get through. I've heard it said comedy is just tragedy plus time.
I do believe
that.
I'm just laughing here because I just imagine myself. I'm always laughing in the most tragic situations, and it's not okay. I don't know what it is. One of my best friends also said, for him, he was taking care of his grandma who had dementia until the very end, and he was helping her change her diapers and everything, and he just started busting out laughing one day, and I'm like, wait, dude, why are you laughing? This is not okay. Like,
yeah,
this is really serious. He's like, seriously, though, my mom and I talk about it, and at this point, what else can we do except to laugh? Because we've been so upset and sad and traumatized by the situation. At the end of the day, you just have to laugh it off. I absolutely agree with what you're saying. It's such a balance. Every time there is tragedy, there's always humor too, comedy. And whether that means it's because it's a way of handling tragedy or just it's a fine balance of how the universe is. Absolutely.
Totally.
I'm so excited for this book.
And I was just going to add, too, that in my life, comedy has really been a survival mechanism during sad times. Being in high school and being lonely, I had comedy and I had my few friends who got my jokes. In junior high, I really used to get picked on and bullied a lot until I became friends with this really big kid who I made laugh. And I sort of got myself a bodyguard in comedy. And so he would kind of like stick up for me and protect me. And I paid him in joke. It's always been there for me. It's always been that survival mechanism. And sometimes times are really sad. I joke around more. I'm sure people are like, how can you joke around at a time like this? How can I not? What else can I do?
Yeah, exactly. Jokes are the best kind of currency when you think about it. It truly is. And I totally relate to you in that way too, because I am that person where people are like, wait, this is not the appropriate time to laugh right now. Okay, yes, I understand. But at the same time, we've gone through everything we could with the sad part. Just have a little laugh about things. Look back at that in a more positive way, I guess you can say, right? It's a coping mechanism. It's fascinating to me how humor and jokes find their way so naturally with tragedy. I love that you actually in real life did make a big friend to be your bodyguard. So that's like your real life Travis.
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's a scene in The Serpent King where it's talking about a time when Travis was stuck up for Dill. That scene, minus the awful consequences in the book, is pretty autobiographical.
Talking about Travis, circling back to your characters, Travis, I think I could accurately say for everybody that he definitely held a soft spot for a lot of us, or all of us. And oh my gosh, that character just freaking killed me. Just in case this is kind of like a spoiler alert for listeners, but I'm hoping that you all read Serpent King by now. Hopefully it's not too much of a spoiler alert, but if not, pause this and go please pick up a copy right now and then come back after you finish the book. The real life version of Travis Lee, are you guys still in touch? Are you still friends with that person in high school?
That person in high school, really the only similarity he bore in common with Travis was his size.
Okay.
He didn't actually have much in common with Travis. Travis is much more based on not any one person, but a type of person who I would encounter who fascinated me. I worked at a bookstore for a few years back in high school and college, and these guys would come in, these big blue-collar looking guys, you know, wearing muddy jeans and muddy work boots. They would come in and they would grab these huge stacks of novels, like Wheel of Time series, and plop them down on the counter. You could see their hands were just scarred up, and you could tell they worked hard for a living, digging ditches, I don't know. They looked in all respects just like a construction worker or a farmer. And then you would look closer and you'd see these strange details about them. They would be wearing a dragon necklace like Travis does, or they would be wearing those Renaissance festival boots tucked in with their jeans tucked into them, or they'd have a staff with them, or just generally things that would lead you to conclude that they very much lived in a world of imagination. And I wondered about that coming together of cultural elements, this blue-collar redneck who loves fantasy novels. There's a real American tradition for hardscrabble rural America loving fantasy. I mean, Robert E. Howard, who wrote the Conan books, who pioneered a certain type of fantasy, he was from some Nowheresville, Texas. So this is the thing in America. I wanted to get to know that person who I would see. I wanted to get to know who that was and what created that kind of person. So that's really where Travis came from. It's just been amazing to me, the reaction to that character. I mean, even people who give my book terrible reviews will be like, but I did like Travis. He was so incredibly fun to write, because this is a type of person that exists in the world, and I feel I haven't read that character yet. Doesn't mean that character isn't out there. It just means that I hadn't read him yet, and so I wanted for him to be in a book somewhere, because I feel like such an interesting character deserves to be in a book.
It's just something so pure about him too. Really good kindness out there. And it's just so refreshing to see that. Again, spoiler alert, talk about freaking tragedy and you killing us and making us cry like babies. Really? Come on now.
Well, if it's any comfort, so I wrote most of The Serpent King on the bus on my iPhone to and from work.
Okay, I'm cutting in right now. You are such a show off right now. I just wish I could just look at my phone without getting nauseous on the bus. So yeah, okay, continue on, Miss William C. Morris Award written on the bus. All right.
I'm really only bragging about my right thumb dexterity and my inner ear. I've got a good inner ear. What can I say? When I got to the scene that you were talking about with Travis, I was writing that on the bus, and I really just started to lose it to the point where I had to pull the cord to stop the bus, and I had to get off the bus and just sit in a grocery store parking lot by this street and just compose myself so that I could be dignified. And then I went and got back on the next bus and
continued
on my way home.
I love that you suffered as much as we did. So good.
Oh, I did. I did. It was very difficult. Even knowing from the very beginning how his story would turn out, even knowing from the very beginning, it was still difficult to write. It still was not enjoyable.
Hey, when you're pulling all these punches, okay, like you're like going in for these several different drafts of finding the best way in basically killing us and making us suffer throughout the scene. Like you said, you already had an idea of how it was going to happen. Did you stick to that one idea, or you tested out three or four different versions of how it was going to come to be?
I had an idea for how Travis would meet his end in the beginning, that there was going to be four friends instead of three friends. This was the idea I had at the very, very beginning. There were going to be four friends. And one of the friends was going to be even an outcast among the outcasts. This friend wasn't even really going to fit in very well with Travis, Dill, and Lydia. And this friend was going to really struggle to the point where this character, and you'll notice that I'm very vague about this character, and I'll explain why in a second, but this character was going to bring a gun on the last day of school and shoot people.
Whoa.
And Travis was going to stop that and be killed in the process. So there were two reasons why that plot line never made it into the book. The first is that that character never revealed themselves to me. They would not tell me anything about themselves. They would not tell me their name. They would not tell me their gender. They would not tell me any of their motivations. They would not tell me their relationship with Dill, Lydia, and Travis. They would not tell me anything about themselves. They wouldn't let me get to know them. I couldn't write that character. Well, I guess there's three reasons. The second reason is that that would have turned The Serpent King into a school shooting book. And I did not set out to write a school shooting book. There are many excellent books. Well, not, I don't know about many, but there are several excellent books of which I'm personally aware that deal with that specific subject. And they do it so wonderfully with so much grace. It's just not the book I was ready to write. And it would have become that book in people's minds. So I didn't want that. And the third reason is that that would have been a very traditionally heroic death for Travis. There's no ambiguity there. That is just straight up heroism. Whereas the way he meets his end in The Serpent King, I wanted to challenge the reader to find the heroism in that. Because I do believe there was heroism in the way he met his end and the way he died. It requires you to look for it. And there's even a part in The Serpent King where I challenge the reader to disagree with me, where I basically say that he died for nothing. And I hope by that point in the story, the reader reads that and says, no, that's not true. He lived the life he wanted to live. He was who he was. And his death, while tragic and senseless, capped off a great life, as short as it was. And I kind of wanted to talk about the way that even a short life can have tremendous value, can have tremendous accomplishment, can really be a full and complete life within its own context.
I'm sitting here like, wow, it's like he's making a speech. This is beautiful. That was really well said.
Do you really want to know what it is?
Tell me your secret.
Okay, my day job is as a prosecutor for the state of Tennessee.
Wait, are you serious?
Yeah, no, I'm totally serious. I'm a prosecutor. That's what I do during the day for my health insurance. And there's stuff in The Serpent King that I drew from real cases on. There's stuff in Goodbye Days that I drew from real cases on. So yeah, and that's my day job. And in that day job, I have to do a lot of speaking. I have to answer a lot of questions and think on my feet. I've just had a lot of practice at it.
I had no idea. Now I can't help but ask you.
Sure.
Here I am just assuming you're at home writing your books, your award-winning books, and all of that. Okay, so how the hell do you make time between being a prosecutor and an author? How?
Really, the secret is just making the most of the time that I do have. So that means that instead of driving to work, which would be a lot quicker than taking the bus, I take the bus into work and I write on the bus. So I have about a 35 or 40 minute commute each way. And on those two commutes, I can generally do about 500 words, maybe even 1,000 words if I really get on a tear and really plan out what I want to say. And I'll also sometimes write over my lunch hour at work. I do a lot of planning in my head so that I don't waste time when I go to write. I don't just sort of fly by the seat of my pants because I don't have time to do that. I'll go for a walk at night when I get home from work, and that's kind of my planning time. And I think about what I want to say. I think about where I want to go with my next scene. Things like that. It's really about when it's working time, it's working time. And I like don't check the internet. I really just buckle down and get it done. And if you write at the rate of 1,000 words a day, that's 60,000 words in 2 months. You know, that's basically a book. I mean, The Serpent King is 77,000 words and Goodbye Days is 88,000 words. If you write clean and you write clear, And in my day job, too, I do a ton of writing. I write all day in my day job, 8 to 4:30 every day. I just write. I'm always working on deadlines there. I've gotten a lot of practice in getting it right the first time and getting it clean and clear and saying what you want to say the first time because I just don't have time to fumble around. So
yeah. Okay. So we have a lot of listeners who are parents and they're struggling with, not really struggling, but it's not exactly the easiest. Let's just say like having to come home after work, having kids to take care of, like, you know, obviously you want to spend as much time as possible with your children as well, but also make time for your own passion and your art. It's inspiring just to hear how other people do it and just figure out time. It's nice to kind of shake up your routine as well and just, hey, let me try what Jeff said and let me try taking the bus or train into work and scheduling those 30 minutes or block out those 40 minutes in transit to write my story. That was really, really helpful.
That's one of my big missions in life, is to hopefully impart to people this idea that you can be creative around the edges of a normal life. Mm. You can be creative and have a day job. In fact, I think it helped. I don't know that I would want to be a full-time writer. I mean, I guess it would be nice to sell that many books that I could be a full-time writer. But honestly, I don't think I would do any more writing if I were a full-time writer. I would do more reading. Yeah, I would really just read a lot more books. I wouldn't do any more writing, I think, than I currently do now. And I think the writing I would do would be harder because I would have economic considerations driving my writing. As it stands right now, I don't think about what's going to sell when I write.
Interesting.
I think about telling the best story. Whereas I know myself well enough to know that if I didn't have a source of income that was such that I could never write another book and I could still feed my family, I could still put a roof over our head, if I didn't have that and had to depend on my imagination to provide that, I would come to resent my imagination. I would come to view my imagination as something I'm fighting against for survival. I'm not bohemian, devil-may-care personality like, oh, a bluebird will bring the rent check in through the window next month. It will be fine. I really focus on material survival first and foremost. If there's any question about my financial situation, my state of survival, where the next meal is going to come from, where the next rent check is going to come from, all of my energy goes towards solving that problem. And none of it would be left over for writing. So I just absolutely have to have either a day job or I have to be selling books like James Patterson to where I would never have to write another book and I would be completely fine. One of those two I would have to be able to create art.
That is really inspiring. Like I mentioned, we have a lot of listeners who are parents, but also we have a lot of listeners who are graduating college or just graduated and feeling torn. You know, like, do I give it my all and give up everything and just dive in writing? But then what about finances? Can I make it that way? Or should I accept this 9-to-5 position? And they're worried, how can I balance in my writing? That is really, really helpful and really inspiring to those who do have jobs who are thinking about leaving their jobs, because all we're hearing now is working from home, and which is great. It's fantastic for a lot of people, but it's also refreshing to hear there are writers and authors like you out there who do really love your daytime job and you appreciate it because it gives you more ammunition for your art in itself.
Sure. And I would say too, I am far from extraordinary in keeping a day job and writing as well. In fact, pretty much every writer I know either has a day job of some sort or they have some other source of income, be it a spouse who works and has a good job and is able to support the both of them, or even money. They've inherited money or have family money or something like that. There's something there that allows them to do that. I know very, very, very few writers who are able to support themselves just with the sales of their books and without any help from anybody else. Just know to your listeners out there, there's nothing extraordinary about me writing books with a day job. So many writers do it, and you can do it. A book I would recommend to all writers is Big Magic by Elizabeth Gilbert. Phenomenal book. And she's such an advocate for day jobs for all of the reasons that I'm saying here. And I had kind of formed my worldview about this before I read that book of hers. And when I read it, I was like, yeah, that's right on.
Thank you for that. It's truly refreshing. We just keep hearing about how there are a lot of different types of artists, not specifically writers or authors, who do have these amazing at-home lives and you could just pick up and travel anytime you want while doing your art. So it is really nice to hear like that reality check of, hey, most writers have a job and it's nearly unheard of for writers to not have a job. So Jeff, on your Instagram, you had a screenshot of your acceptance speech for the William C. Morris Award, and you were talking about empathy and where we're headed right now as a whole country. There's a lot of fear, especially in rural America. And I'd love to dive into that a little bit more. Recently, we've had a lot of authors on the show, especially after the elections, having these conversations. Mostly it's about diversity that I've been having these conversations about. And yours was an interesting point about rural America. And you have the right to say what you're saying because you've had experience with your own eyes. You see and you hear yourself. And it's not just like a generalization. So I'd love to dive in there a little bit more. In rural America, did you witness these fears that you were talking about that was festering?
My feeling about rural America, and especially the rural South, is very complex because I love rural America. When I was a musician, I played the music forms of rural America. I played blues. I played country music. I think rural America is an amazing place, and it's produced so many great American artists, which is sort of my measure of the worth of a place, what kind of artists it produces. It's produced such amazing artists. The South is such a beautiful, complex place, but you can't love those places without acknowledging their weaknesses too. Right now, as we've had in years past in America, we've got this poison in rural America, and this poison is fear. Politicians have figured out how best to exploit this fear of what is different. People who are from the outside of things that are strange and that they don't understand. They figured out how to use religion and, frankly, in my opinion, pervert religion and pervert Christianity, which again can be a beautiful thing when it takes the right form. All of that is going on in rural America. I mean, you've got very skillful people who have figured out how to get rural Americans, rural Southerners, to vote out of fear against their own best interests. It's very distressing to me, and I truly believe that the antidote to this is greater empathy and greater knowledge of the truth of people's lives. And I think stories are the best way to confront people with the truth of other people's lives and experience. I think it's so hard to deny the humanity of another person once you've been confronted with the truth of their experience, with the truth of their stories. I remember, this may seem like a silly example, but I remember growing up and my family would watch The Cosby Show. So I would see Black Americans living their lives and I would see Black culture and I would see they're like me. Cliff Huxtable likes sandwiches like me. They love each other the way my family loves each other. They are the same as me. They're not different. They're not anything to be afraid of. So it was confronting the truth of their lives through stories that gave me greater empathy. And it made me want to consume more stories, which gave me more insight into people's lives, which made me, I think, more empathetic. And it's the opposite of a vicious cycle. It's a wonderful cycle, but they need to get hooked on stories first. I kind of see my role in this as trying to reach rural Americans with stories. That's what I really want to do. And I want to tell stories about people like them who are discovering better ways to be and who are discovering that they don't have to be bound to the poisonous traditions of the past. They aren't bound to that. They can be better than that. They're better than their blood. They're better than their legacy that they've been handed. This is a thing I think about a lot as a Southern writer, is this legacy of this place that I love. It is a decidedly mixed legacy. There are horrible things that have happened in the past in the South that we can't forget. And that's a shameful part of the history here. And there are good things. And it's about being better than the past and not making the same mistakes as the past. I'm a big student of history and I'm a big believer in not repeating the mistakes of history. And so it's very frustrating to me to see America going down the path.
Yeah,
of
it's kind of regressing
repeating
again.
Mistakes. Yeah. It's really troubling to me to see politicians making the kind of statements and taking the kind of positions that when I was a kid would have ended their career. When I was growing up in the 90s, I remember the sportscaster Jimmy the Greek saying Black people are better athletes because they naturally have bigger muscles or something like that. he just lost it. I mean, he lost his job. It was like, obviously he was going to lose his job.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now we have politicians.
It's acceptable
like,
now, which is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bullshit.
Just
yeah.
Saying, like really openly white supremacist things. It's unbelievably distressing to me. I think it's terrifying. And my hope is in the youth. I think that the people who promote hate are making systemic changes to our government right now that are going to make it difficult, that are going to make it challenging to make changes for the better. We need a demographic wave to sweep through government. We need this next generation coming up to be so good and so empathetic and so much better than the generations who have voted in the problems we have now. We need them to just sweep it away. And I think the way we're going to build that good generation is through stories, honestly.
I have a pretty heavy loaded question here, and this is just a genuine question that I'm very curious about because I'm trying to figure it out too. By talking to more and more guests and authors especially, I absolutely agree with you 110% that we really need to invest in our younger generation because they are our hope. And I do believe that they can make a huge wave and a huge change. I absolutely believe it. My sisters are in that generation and I see it. I see those changes that they're really pushing hard to make. But what about now? What about the generations now? Do you have any thoughts on what we can do?
I think that's really the secret. I think younger generations have to have those hard conversations with the older generations. The biggest existential threat, I think, to our country is the ability people have now to live in a world completely devoid of fact. The fact
yeah.
that you can live in a world where you get your news only from Breitbart and only from Fox News.
Yeah.
It allows you to live in a world that's completely divorced from the world of reality. And it's so
yep.
distressing to me. After the election, I've got the little news app on my iPhone and I added Fox News into it so I could see what are they seeing? What are the other side? What kind of news are they getting? What is happening here that they're making such bad choices, I think. And so every day I see the headlines on Fox News and they are just not dealing with the issues of the real world. And then we've got the president out attacking the news media, telling people not to trust them. I just think that is such an unbelievable threat to our democracy, this starvation of information. I think young people have to be the standard bearers for good information, for correct information, for
accurate,
correct
yep.
narratives.
Truthful
yeah.
reporting. What kind of news resources or sources do you recommend? Because this is actually a conversation I've had just last night with a really dear friend of mine who's very well-read about all of this, and she travels a lot. And we talk about, because I travel a lot too, where international news, it's so important for America to also hear what international news is reporting as well, because you get this
sure.
whole other side and you're like, holy crap, wait, what are we doing to each other? And what, no matter which side you're on, which way you're leaning, left or right, it's everybody would just be like, wait, what? That's how America is seen? Is that really what's happening? But also BBC, New York Times, I love podcasts, I love NPR.
Yep.
I mean, is there any
yep.
sources that you can recommend to our listeners if they're hungry and wanting to learn more about truthful, accurate reporting?
I think the gold standard of international reporting is the BBC. I think the gold standard of domestic
yeah.
reporting accuracy is NPR. I love NPR. I think they're tremendously reliable. I think they're as balanced as they can be. I don't believe that there are always two sides to every story. I don't believe that all opinions are equally valid. So yes, they do display a bias, but I believe it's a bias toward the truth.
Mm.
I think the New York Times is still the gold standard for newspaper journalism. The Washington Post is amazing. You have to be careful not to get them confused, because the New York Post is a crappy newspaper and the Washington
mm-hmm.
Times is a crappy newspaper. So you got to
yeah.
keep those straight. If you want a news source that I think is pretty reputable that leans conservative, you can do the Wall Street Journal.
Oh,
the
I like
Economist
that. Yes.
is a good resource. These are news sources that lean a little rightward. Nobody's going to accuse the Wall Street Journal of being a liberal rag. But I would say 95% of my news comes from a combination of Washington Post, New York Times, NPR. I have not been loving CNN in recent years, but I do still get a little information from CNN. news outlets like the Huffington Post, things like that, I like them because they confirm my existing worldviews a lot of the time, but I don't necessarily recommend them as highly as I recommend the others.
Huffington Post, it's interesting. That's a tricky one. I know so many people who love it, but I can never rely on them ever. Like I see Huffington Post and I just switch it off. I'm just like, next, maybe it's because if there's some pieces that are more opinionated and I'm just like, wait, who's writing this right now? Is this an actual reporter or just somebody who just has a thought and just wants to just say whatever they feel like they're saying? So interesting. Huffington Post, I can't seem to rely on at all. But I do love that you did mention Washington Post because I didn't think of that before. So thank you for that. I think my friend also recommended Al Jazeera.
Al Jazeera's good too.
I haven't checked that one out yet at all, but I actually heard about it and then she reminded me about it. So I got to check that out too. I appreciate this because I feel like our community as a whole is just wanting to learn more and more. And I think it's so important to see that you being a role model of theirs is, wow, okay, so he's obviously wanting to learn more and also get accurate information, and really inspires them to also stay true to accurate information and leaning towards those kind of sources as well. Thank you. And you mentioned about religion when I was talking about your acceptance speech. I grew up being raised by a Buddhist family, and I have aunts and a great-grandma that was Christian. I was more so having the viewpoint of a Buddhist. With different religions, I didn't know too much about Christianity until college because the school that I went to, it's a huge Jewish population.
Oh,
I thought I was part Jewish growing up. I learned about Christianity during my freshman year and sophomore year of college, and just learning about it, it was very beautiful to understand Christianity too, from what I was taught. So Pentecostalism, listeners, if you're not really sure about Pentecostalism, please look it up. From your own experiences, can you share with us what was that like and how was that like growing up? And that has a lot to do with legacy too, and about expectations from parents.
Well, let me just say, first of all, I did not grow up Pentecostal. I grew up in a strict religious background that I don't really talk about it a lot publicly, the specific religious background I grew up in. Just suffice it to say, I grew up in a strict religious Christian background that has sort of some, to outsiders, they would be very odd practices, but it was not Pentecostal. I am familiar with Pentecostal practices. I've attended Pentecostal churches on numerous occasions. I've got a lot of friends who either are Pentecostal or grew up Pentecostal. More friends who grew up Pentecostal than are currently Pentecostal. I'm a little too much of a heathen for people who are currently Pentecostal. I am very familiar with the practices. And let me just talk a little bit about the particular strain of Pentecostalism that appears in The Serpent King, because it is very uniquely American. It's very uniquely Southern, and specifically rural Southern. Pentecostal snake handling arises out of a verse in the Bible, Mark 16:18. And it says basically, if you are a true disciple, if you're a true believer, then you can pick up snakes and not be harmed. You can drink deadly poisons and not be harmed. Now, most religious sects view that verse metaphorically, but Pentecostal snake handling religions, sects, view that quite literally. And so as a show of faith, as a sign of belief, because they believe that these signs will follow the people who believe, they actually handle snakes during their religious services. They will actually drink poisonous substances, be it strychnine, battery acid, poisonous substances during their worship services. So that's part of their worship service. Part of their worship service is speaking in tongues, which comes from the Bible. On the day of Pentecost, the Holy Ghost descended upon believers and they were able to speak in tongues, in different languages. These Pentecostal religions will have these ecstatic worship services where they speak in unknown languages. To experience it is very beautiful and strange, and I'm sure some people would find it very, very creepy because I'm comfortable with strange religion and I grew up around odd religious practice. It's not so strange to me. It's something that I can kind of take in stride. But that's sort of the foundation for the religion in The Serpent King. And as you might imagine, there's not a unified body of snake handling churches. There's not like a snake handling pope or something who hands down edicts on behalf. All of the snake handling churches are ad hoc affairs created by individuals. The Church and the Serpent King doesn't really exist. I believe I called it the Church of Christ's Disciples with Signs Following. That is my own invention and is the invention of Pastor Dillard Early Sr. in the book. That's what's going on from a religious standpoint. And these Pentecostal religions tend to be very strict. They have dress codes, especially for the women, codes of conduct. They might say no dancing. They might say no alcohol. It's not religion for the faint-hearted, let me put it that way.
When you're saying odd practices, and I just want to share a little bit just so that also you understand that I am absolutely not coming in with any judgment. It's more so an understanding too. My aunt was a nun, and there are certain Buddhist practices where it shows, in a way, faith as well.
Sure.
And similar to intaking toxic substances, what my aunt did was when I went to Taiwan to watch one of the ceremonies or rituals, you could say, they believe that when you have a lot of faith, in a way, the Buddhas or the certain deities can enter your body, and to show that you can take pain. So whether it's taking these metal balls with spikes that can really do some damage to your body, they'll beat it over their backs. I can't remember if it was the head, but let's just say it was beating on the flesh. I remember my aunt was taking a bunch of, you know, the incense stick. They were lit, and she was able to put a bunch of them in her mouth and down her throat to show that she didn't get burnt and that she was okay. And she was able to be in this complete trance. I'm sure some people might see that as odd, but for me, that's what I grew up with. I've seen that and I find it fascinating. I'm currently learning more about Buddhism to hopefully practice more. But for me, I just kind of want to learn more about different religions overall. Thank you for sharing yours. I feel like with any kind of religion, with that, there's also that family expectation of almost like passing down, where almost expected for the children to carry on that religion or those practices related to your book, The Serpent King. Like, how did that affect relationships with parents and children, and the children not wanting to be a part of it anymore, or just wanting to leave and discover other types of religions, or just getting a break away from it? How was that like?
So in The Serpent King, it's really had a devastating impact on my main character's life. Dill's father was the pastor of their snake handling church. He was sent to prison for a really heinous crime. And his mother has been left to raise him. And they live this very aesthetic life. They don't have a TV. They don't have a computer. They're very much cut off from the outside world. It leads his mother to discourage him from going to college or even finishing high school, because within their world, within their religious practice, that kind of education isn't important. It's not important that you know about this world. What's important is that you know about the world to come, and you know about sort of the godly world. And it's created tremendous difficulty and tension for him, because there's this expectation that he's just going to keep living the life that his parents set out for him, that they think God set out for him. But he wants his own life. He wants his own path. He doesn't want what he's inherited. And he struggles with it because he does still believe in God. He does still have faith. It's just not the faith of his parents. It looks different from their faith. And his parents don't really have the ideological flexibility to accept that. He's understanding that if he wants to follow his own path and be the person he wants to be, it's going to come at the cost of his relationship with his parents, which can happen. He struggles a lot, too, with his father's hypocrisy. I mean, his father was this man of God who basically tried to get Dill, my main character, to take the fall for him. In the story, Dill's father goes to prison for having child pornography on his computer. It's revealed that Dill testified against his father at the trial at the behest of the prosecutors that, no, this wasn't mine. I didn't download this. He didn't say that his father did, but he eliminated himself from the possibility because the defense was trying to say, hey, look, this is pornography of teenage girls. You have a teenage son. He probably did it. And so Dill got up and said, no, I didn't. He's dealing with his father's hypocrisy, where even as they both know, Dill knows and his father know, that that was not Dill's pornography, that it was his father's. They both know that. And even knowing that, Dill's father will look him in the eyes and pretend to be holy, pretend to be still this godly man who has the moral authority to dictate Dill's life to him. And that's tremendously distressing to Dill. It's a source of great consternation for him, especially as he sees good fathers like Lydia's father, who's like the platonic ideal of a father. He's so warm and kind and loving and generous.
Was this one of the cases that you came across as a prosecutor?
Yes.
Oh, nice. Okay, so this actually happened.
I mean, it wasn't exactly with a snake-handling preacher, but it was with a preacher.
Interesting. Whoa. So that was definitely the talk of the town.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow. Talk about a day job really giving you a lot of inspiration. That's so inspiring to hear that. For me, I usually like to look at the analytical side of the research process. So for that, did you have to dive into like further research, or did you just have this general idea of this case and then you riffed off of it and created your own ideas in your head, or did you have to do more backup research?
For the legal stuff, I didn't really have to do much research. For the snake handling stuff, I did do more research. I talked to friends who had attended snake handling churches. There's a book out there that's a really great resource if you're curious about these snake handling churches. It's called Salvation on Sand Mountain. And it won the National Book Award back in the 90s. It's a narrative nonfiction book. It's a very quick read. It's a gorgeous book, and I highly recommend it.
I love that. We have a listener question from Jean Rodrigue, and she knows that 2016 is your big debut author year, and that usually creates a lot of hype around the author, which is you. She would like to know what it's like to have to move past that first year experience onto your next project.
The young adult community gets very excited about debuts. That's just kind of the nature of the community. Everyone's excited about the new face, the new voices. One thing that's really just a natural thing is for there to be somewhat less hype about your second book, because you're kind of more of a known quantity. The people who liked your first book are hopefully excited for your second book. The people who didn't like your first book are probably not going to check in with you on your second book. In general, it's just a little more muted, and you just can't really take it personally. It's just part of how things go. And so I do feel the hype around Goodbye Days has been less than The Serpent King in some ways. More in other ways. In general, it's different. And there's kind of a natural inclination at times, I think, to view different as bad. But different isn't necessarily bad. Sometimes different is just different.
Nicely said. And she'd also like to know, what would you like to see more of in fiction? Are there any groups of characters that you'd like to see more often? Are there any themes or subjects that you'd like to see represented in future works?
Oh, interesting. Specifically, I love stories about economic disparity, because I think that's one of the biggest challenges facing our nation. I think I lived in Brazil for a time, and one of the distressing things about that country is the tremendous divide between the haves and the have-nots. The concentration of wealth in the hands of a very few people really produces some problems in society. And I love to see especially young adult taking that on. I'm also just fascinated by stories about environments that are so outside of my experience. I just read a bound manuscript of a 2018 release called A Girl Like That by Tanaz Bethina. I hope I'm pronouncing her last name correctly. I've only ever read it. I've never heard it said. She writes about an academy in Saudi Arabia that Indian students attend. And it's so fascinating to me because it's a different culture on top of a different culture. And to see the differences, but then the similarities to what I know growing up was so incredibly fascinating. And I would love to read more books like that that aren't even set in the United States. It was truly a revelatory and fascinating experience. I loved reading that. I love reading books about different cultures coming together. So, for example, Nicola Yoon's The Sun Is Also a Star. Absolutely one of my favorite young adult books of all time, really. And I just loved reading that and reading the story of a Jamaican girl and a Korean young man who come together. Those kind of stories I'm always hungry for. I just love experiencing things outside of my own experience. And those are the kind of stories I find myself drawn to.
I love that. Jeff, I would really love to jump into Goodbye Days. For those who might not have had a chance to pick up Goodbye Days yet, could you give us a little snapshot of what Goodbye Days is about?
So Goodbye Days is about a young man struggling with grief and guilt in the wake of an accident that killed his three best friends. And the catch is that my main character, Carver is his name, may have caused that accident by texting them while they were driving to come pick him up. So he's encountering just tremendous guilt, tremendous grief. He's having panic attacks and seeing a therapist after his very supportive older sister browbeat him into it. He is finding comfort and solace in the friendship of the girlfriend of one of his friends who died. One of the issues is that they're starting to get close and form a close friendship, and that's adding to the guilt. One of the fathers of one of the young men who died is a powerful judge in Nashville, where this story takes place, and he's pressuring the district attorney to bring criminal charges against my main character. And this is something I drew upon my day job for, was coming up with a legal theory by which somebody who was texting their friends while driving could potentially be held criminally liable for negligent homicide. While all of this is happening, this maelstrom of grief and guilt, terror and sadness and loneliness, one of the grandmothers of one of the young men who died invites my main character to spend a goodbye day with her, where they go and they do the things that they would have done if they'd had the chance with the loved one before he died. And it's sort of a day of remembrance where they share parts of his story that the other doesn't have and put together their pieces, try to recreate his story for a day. He ends up going on goodbye days with the other two families, and they're very different experiences with very different revelations, very different motivations, very different demons addressed. And it's really just about his story of traveling through this valley of grief and guilt to the other side.
Wow. Again, you have very strong skill in making people cry. Listeners who have not picked up the book yet, also pick up a box of tissues, FYI.
I will tell you that my mom didn't cry during Serpent King. She did cry during Goodbye Days, for whatever that's worth.
So y'all better get ready. This is something that I've had talks with friends about, where it's, what if that does happen, where something, knock on wood, happens to the person driving and it truly was caused by someone texting? What happens in that case? That actual scenario is what your whole book is based on. Was that also one of the cases? I know that you look through your cases to see what would happen, how you can be charged for that, for negligent murder. Was that an actual case?
It wasn't an actual case. It's based on my reading of Tennessee law, and it's also based on my observation of prosecutors using the law in more creative ways to address some of the problems of the digital age. For example, using laws to get at internet bullying. There's an example in Massachusetts of a girl who texted her friend and encouraged him to kill himself. And
yes,
he did,
I read
kill
that.
Himself, so she was charged there. And so the idea is that prosecutors are having to get more creative with the law to try to find ways to address behaviors and incidents.
I am happy that you do touch on this, because it is a serious thing when all these ads now are being sponsored and aired on even radios, saying, you know, make sure you don't text and drive, and don't even pick up your phone to check your messages. It's, you can see that a lot now. It wasn't that obvious just a few years ago, but now it's like really everywhere. I am so happy that a book like this is out there for the youth to read from an influential author who they look up to. So thank you for touching on this topic. And you do such a beautiful job in balancing hope and pain in your book for Goodbye Days. And I am just wondering how you're able to shape the novel in a way where we understand the possibilities about moving on from tragic events. How were you able to do that? I mean, obviously you're a very naturally gifted writer, but also, was there any inspiration that you drew from? Was there a book that you read that touched really beautifully, really well on moving on from tragedies they drew from? Or if there was a craft writing book on really diving into the different layers of grief and tragedy?
Part of it is based on my fundamental bedrock worldview that there's always hope. I am just a hopeful person, And I believe that there's always hope. So even in dark days politically, I'm still hopeful. I believe that there's always hope. The one good thing about getting older is you have more aches and pains, but you also have a greater perspective on the peaks and valleys of life. And you see that every valley is followed by a peak. Life just gets better somehow. So there's always hope. So there's that. There's dealing some with grief in my own life, although I will say I haven't dealt with grief the way many people have. Some people have lost many, many friends, and I haven't lost many, many people close to me. I've lost just a few, and I feel really fortunate in that. I really took as two books as my Bible on grief, which is The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion and Blue Nights, also by Joan Didion. Those are the two books, the two grief memoirs that she wrote after the death of her husband and after the death of her daughter. And I just worship Joan Didion. I think she's an amazing writer. She writes with such grace and eloquence about grief and about the thought processes. So those two books were really my guide. And it's hard to write about grief because it takes so many different forms. So it's hard and easy. I mean, it's hard to get it too wrong because it takes so many different forms. But on the other hand, you are always left wondering if you got it right.
Wow, that's powerful. Jeff, you have been so awesome.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been a ball.
You're so awesome. Seriously, I really appreciate you opening up like this. For the three questions, these are going to be rapid fire questions. The first one would be tips on writing query letters.
Oh boy, I didn't get my agent by querying. I got my agent through a friend. I handed my manuscript to her to read and critique, and she handed it over to her agent. So I never queried for the Serpent King. But I did query a manuscript before the Serpent King that was sort of a realistic post-apocalyptic story. And I didn't get any bites on it because at that time, nobody was buying anything that smelled remotely dystopian in YA. I don't know if my query letter was successful at all because my query letter could have been great, but nobody wants a post-apocalyptic book. I'm afraid my answer is I am no help at all.
This really shows like there are so many different ways of getting representation.
There truly
and
are. That's,
out there.
That's what my answer is going to be. There's lots of ways to get representation. There we go.
Okay, so next one. How important is it to have a mentor in your career or your life overall?
I think it's very important. There are authors who have served as mentors to me. So for example, in the 2015 debut year, there were some authors that really just kind of took me under their wing and they were wonderful. David Arnold, Adam Silvera, Becky Albertalli. They were just wonderful to me and really talked me through stuff and helped show me the ropes. If you can find yourself a mentor who's been through what you're about to go through, super, super helpful.
Awesome. Wow, that's so funny. We recently just released an episode with Angie Thomas of The Hate U Give, and she was speaking so highly about Adam Silvera and also Becky. So they sound like really cool people.
Very cool.
Very
generous. Yeah.
That's awesome. The third and final rapid fire question. What are small manageable steps you'd advise writers to take every week towards accomplishing their writing goals?
So small manageable steps, I would say create for yourself a sacred parcel of time every day that you write. Guard it from the world, make it a walled garden, keep it sacred, keep it inviolate. That is your time and make it truly writing time. Disconnect your internet if you have to, lock your phone in a box, whatever you have to do to make that sacred writing time, do it. You have got to make the time. You've got to start putting words on the page because you can't fix what isn't there. You can't fix a blank page. So you've got to commit to getting words on the page, and you have to commit to finishing what you started. I know so many people with great ideas who are phenomenal writers, and the only thing that keeps them from being New York Times bestsellers and having books in the world is that they just can't finish what they started. So you've got to finish what you started. So I would say the first thing to do is to set time aside that is your writing time. Even if it's 15 minutes a day, if you're writing 50 words a day, it's going to take you a while to write a novel, but you'll eventually get a novel at writing 50 words a day.
Man, that was so inspiring. Walled garden.
I gave a TED talk once where I laid out my creative manifesto of the walled garden. It's on YouTube. If you just search Jeff Zentner TEDx talk, it'll come up.
Nice.
That's where I
expand
on the walled garden metaphor.
I can't wait to watch it. Jeff, you have been so freaking awesome. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And that wraps up our episode with Jeff Zentner. Jeff, I had such an awesome time chatting with you. Storytellers, I'm so grateful for your support and thank you for listening in and joining us as always. Please say hi to Jeff on Twitter at Jeff Zentner. Jeff recommended a long list of really helpful resources for you to check out, and we have them all linked up in his show notes page over at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Jeff Zentner. If you'd love to support our show by rocking your 88 Cups of Tea swag, head over to 88cupsoftea.com/mug to grab your limited edition 88 Cups of Tea mug signed by yours truly. Thank you so much in advance for showing your love and supporting our show. Don't forget to join our Facebook group if you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with other writers. You can also submit questions for future guests on our show, and we also post sneak peeks of future episodes. Join me over in our new Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. There's tons of love, support, and encouragement going on in this special community of ours. I can't wait to meet you in there.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye.